Welcome to the EDUCAUSE 2009 Annual Conference Podcast. The EDUCAUSE 2009 Annual Conference brought together the most influential IT decision makers and resources to improve the ability of higher education to achieve its mission. This podcast is sponsored by Juniper Networks and Quest Communications International. We feature a session by Lawrence Lessig, Director of the Edward J. Safra Foundation Center for Ethics and Professor of Law at Harvard University. His session is entitled, It's About Time, Getting Our Values Around Copyright Right.
I want to start by making observations on the way to an argument, on the way to saying something about what I think you need to do in a debate that you need to take more seriously. Here are the observations. There are three. Number one, when anybody talks about copyright, we have to remember that there's an extraordinarily large elephant in the room. And the elephant I mean is this. In the past, in the history of culture across the world and in America, copyright had a tiny role. A tiny bit of the ordinary way in which people engage with their culture was regulated by copyright. Here's Jessica Lipman. At the turn of the century, last century, U.S. copyright law was technical, inconsistent, and difficult to understand, but it didn't apply to very many people or very many things. If one were an author or a publisher of books, maps, charts, paintings, sculpture, photographs, or sheet music, a playwright or producer of plays, or a printer, the copyright law bore on one's business. But booksellers, piano roll and phonograph record publishers, motion picture producers, musicians, scholars, members of Congress, and ordinary citizens, consumers, could go about their business without ever encountering a copyright problem. Then things changed radically. The current context is one where copyright now reaches across the spectrum of ways in which we engage in our culture. Here's Lipman again. 90 years later, U.S. copyright law is even more technical, inconsistent, and difficult to understand. More importantly, it touches everyone and everything. Technology, heedless of law, has developed modes that insert multiple acts of reproduction and transmission, potentially actionable events under the copyright statute, into commonplace daily transactions. Most of us can no longer spend even an hour without colliding with copyright law. Now, why was there that change? The critical thing to recognize, and an audience like this will get it, is that there's a technical reason for that change. A reason that ties the technology, the architecture of digital technology, to the architecture of copyright law. Because if copyright law at its core regulates something called copies, then in the analog world, the world Jessica Lipman was speaking of at the turn of the last century, many uses of culture were copyright-free. They didn't trigger copyright law because no copy was made. But in the digital world, very few uses are copyright-free because in the digital world, of course, practically all uses of culture trigger copyright because all uses produce a copy. So think of a physical book in real space. If these are all the uses of a physical book in real space, an important set of those uses are technically unregulated by the law. So to read a book is not a fair use of a book, it's a free use of the book, because to read a book is not to produce a copy. To give someone a book, not a fair use of the book. In America, it's a free use of the book, because to give someone a book is not to produce a copy. To sell a book, in the United States at least, is explicitly exempted from the regulation of copyright law, because to sell a book is not to produce a copy. To sleep on a book in no jurisdiction around the world is regulated by copyright law, because to sleep on a book is not to produce a copy. These unregulated uses of culture are then balanced by a set of important regulated uses necessary to produce the incentives artists and creators need to produce great new work. So, to publish a book requires permission of the copyright owner, because the thought is that monopoly was necessary to create the incentives for at least some authors to produce great new works. And then in the American tradition, there's a thin sliver of exceptions, called fair uses. Uses which otherwise would have been regulated by the law, but which the law says have to remain free to assure that the right set of incentives for building on our culture are preserved. Enter the net, where every single use produces a copy. What that means is this balance between unregulated, regulated, and fair uses radically changes merely because the platform through which we get access to our culture has changed. Changed radically. Not because anybody in this fine institution in Washington was thinking about it, but because the technology through which we get access to our culture has changed. That is the elephant in the room we have to keep in focus as we think about this issue. That's the first observation. Here's the second. Think about this idea of a paradigm case. So, Constitution of the United States, Fourth Amendment to the Constitution of the United States. This is the Fourth Amendment. Actually, it looks a little bit like that. The Fourth Amendment protecting people against unreasonable searches and seizures. The paradigm case that that amendment had in its head was something like this. The search warrant to permit authorities to enter into a building and search for evidence of a crime. Trespass was at the core of the protections that it granted. The framers of the Fourth Amendment didn't much think about a technology like wiretapping, because of course when you wiretap, you don't necessarily have to trespass on anybody's property in order to effect the search that a wiretap makes possible. It's outside the scope of the paradigm case. Or think about Article 1, Section 8, Clause 11. You might, of course, know that to be the War Powers Clause that grants Congress the power to declare war. A lot of presidents have missed that first word in that sentence. Congress that has that power, but put that aside. The paradigm case that the framers were thinking about then was this, right? This kind of war, people physically gathering in order to engage in a confrontation between two states. They didn't think about the dynamic of war that would be presented when wars were simply terrorist acts by non-state actors. Wasn't within the scope of their paradigm case. Or finally, think about this clause, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 8. The progress clause. Congress shall have the power to promote the progress of science by securing for limited times to authors the exclusive right to their writings, otherwise known as the copyright clause. This clause, too, has come to have a paradigm case. The paradigm case, as this clause is now conceived, surrounds people like these people, or these people, or this person. Professionals. That's the conception. These professionals depend upon the exclusive right to control the copies and distribution of their work as part of their business model. Their business model, focused on profit, using copyright as a means to securing that profit. That's what the professional is. And the assumption of copyright according to this paradigm is that if you don't secure enough money to these professionals, we will get less creativity out of these professionals. That's the paradigm of this way of thinking about copyright. Now, I have nothing against professionals. Not that I ever make much money out of my work like this, but, you know, we all aspire to that day when we might think of ourselves as professional in that way. So it's nothing against professionals, but the point is to recognize that, obviously, not all creators are the same in this sense. Not all creators have the same business model. So, as with the paradigm of the Fourth Amendment or the paradigm of the war's power, the copyright's paradigm ignores important cases. So, for example, it ignores amateur creators, by which I don't mean amateurish creators. I mean people who create for the love of what they create and not for the money. These are creators, too. Their creativity has been critical for culture in our past, much more of it in our past. Here's Aldous Huxley in 1927. In the days before machinery, men and women who wanted to amuse themselves, this needs an English-like accent to make it really effective, but I can't do that, were compelled in their humble ways to be artists. Now they sit still and permit professionals to entertain them by the aid of machinery. It is difficult to believe, Huxley says, that general artistic culture can flourish in this atmosphere of passivity. Or about 20 years before him, John Philip Sousa, speaking at the United States Congress about this technology, said, "These talking machines are going to ruin the artistic development of music in this country. When I was a boy, in front of every house in the summer evenings, you would find the young people together singing the songs of the day or the old songs. Today you hear these infernal machines going night and day. We will not have a vocal cord left, Sousa said. The vocal cords will be eliminated by a process of evolution, as was the tale of man when he came from the ape. Now, here's a professional celebrating the critical importance that the amateur has to keeping culture alive and vibrant. This is his hero, young people together, singing the songs of the day and the old songs. And that's the picture, young people together, that he wanted to make sure copyright law didn't squelch. These two are creators. They have their own ecology or business model of creativity. And in their business model, the exclusive rights make no sense. This business model of sharing and critiquing and building upon and playing with others' creativity is excluding and has excluding not at its core. Excluding others is not how that business model succeeds. Now, the point here is simply to recognize all creativity happens within a particular ecology of creativity. Those ecologies of creativity have business models that are different. And a model of copyright appropriate to one can be a model that's harmful to another. Second observation, here's the final. As a law professor, I'm a little surprised by the respect that non-lawyers typically give the law. I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying you shouldn't respect, especially law professors, and I'm not saying you shouldn't obey the law, but I think it's surprising because lawyers, and especially law professors, display no similar respect for the law, right? Our view is constantly a view of skepticism. We constantly ask, demand of the law that it explain to us, how does this make sense? And we never presume that we happen to have a body of regulation that makes sense. We always examine, and where it does make sense, then good for the law, and let's encourage people to follow it. But where it makes no sense, our perspective is that law needs to be changed. Now, this is especially so in the context of copyright. Especially so because of the radical change, as I described in observation number one, of the scope and reach of this law, meaning the law now is reaching in ways never intended, never planned by the framers of this law. So especially so here, we should be skeptical. Three observations. Here's the argument. I want to think about the ecology of creativity in education and science. What does it look like? What is its business model? What is the ethos of these ecologies of creativity? Well, science, we have clear statements of this ethos. Robert Merton famously described the scientific ethos as communistic, as he said, in the non-technical and extended sense of common ownership of goods. The substantive findings of science are a product of social collaboration and are assigned to the community. They constitute a common heritage in which the equity of the individual producer is severely limited. Property rights in science are whittled down to a bare minimum by the rationale of the scientific ethic. The scientist's claim to his intellectual property is limited to that of recognition and esteem, which, if the institution functions with a modicum of efficiency, is roughly commensurate with the significance of the increments brought to the common fund of knowledge. Eponymy, for example, the Copernican system or Boyle's law, is thus at once a mnemonic and a commemorative device. Now, Merton's point was not that you have to be a communist in order to be a scientist. His point instead is that the ecology, the business model of science, doesn't depend upon the exclusive rights model of creativity, the ecology of creativity that we see modern copyright embrace. It's different from that. It is different from this picture of creativity. It is closer to the kind of creativity Sousa was romanticizing. Not that incentives for scientists are irrelevant, but that the incentives are different. And that the quid pro quo of the exclusive rights system can actually be harmful to the ecology of knowledge that science tries to build. Think about education. I don't think education is science in the sense there are parts that are like science. So think scholarship is like science in the sense that we all write scholarly articles and we want others to copy and distribute them as broadly as we can, and we don't get paid when people copy. Our business model is distribution freely. Restrictive distribution is inconsistent with that business model. But there are other parts of education that are not quite the same as science. So textbook markets or scholarly books themselves. These are not quite what Sousa was romanticizing and certainly not quite what Britney Spears embodies here. They're not for free, but they're not made for the money. And which rights or which system of rights for education makes sense is a much more difficult question. So if we make the system of rights surrounding education more like the Britney Spears model, then collaboration will be harder. If we make it more like the John Philip Sousa amateur model, incentives for extra type of work here will be weakened. So what we need is a hybrid of models in the context of educational creativity. Within a technical context, informed by the technical capacity of digital technologies that once again makes sense. Step one. Step two. If that's so, if it's true that there are a diversity of business models for creativity, if there's a different ecology for creativity depending upon the domains within which we are speaking and acting, then we should expect a certain resistance by scientists and educators to the current regime. We should see a resistance to imposing the Britney Spears model of copyright upon the scientist or the educator. Not that we should see a rejection of copyright, that's a mistake, but a resistance to the imperialistic approach. We should instead see an approach that skeptically examines copyright and demands proof that this model, as applied to the worlds that we know, makes sense. But if you would expect that, you would be very disappointed by, in fact, what we see out there in the scientific and educational communities. Rather than a resistance to the demands of one model of copyright, the past 20 years has increasingly seen enormous pressure from the top in all of these industries to embrace this model of copyright. The field has been captured by an idea, a paradigm, a foreign import into our domains of a creativity according to a model of hers with little resistance from scientists and educators, too little skepticism by the experts within science and education to the sense that this model might have. Which leads to point three. Stop it. Stop believing. Stop believing, stop listening, stop deferring. Feel entitled to question this system. And I'm here to deliver to you this certificate of entitlement. The bearer of the certificate, an educator or one trained in a field of science, is hereby officially entitled to question whether copyright law as currently crafted makes sense for education or science. You have this right, signed by a professor at Harvard University, so go with it. Because the point is, this deference to the people I produce for a living, lawyers, people who confuse the paradigm case with the universal case, is destructive of science and education. And you, not lawyers, need to take responsibility for that destruction. You have an obligation to protect science and education, and you need to do better in that act of protecting these important domains of culture. So, how would you do that? Well, here's the question you need to ask. If there's a business model of science or a business model of education that depends upon sharing, depends upon resources held in common, that builds upon that common set of resources, how does the paradigm case help that business model? So, for example, think about academic journals. How does the paradigm Britney Spears model help here? Well, the answer differs depending upon the context. You can start by asking, how does it hurt? For rich American universities, the model of academic journals, which of course, as you know, are extraordinarily expensive, the costs of which are going through the roof faster than inflation, that cost doesn't matter much to the rich American universities. We just suck it up. But for the rest of the universities in America and around the world that don't consider themselves to be these rich universities, this is a significant cost. Indeed, around the world, even nominal cost to getting access to these journals is prohibited. Blocking the spread of knowledge. Blocking the spread of knowledge globally to people who could depend and build upon that knowledge if only they had free and fair access to that knowledge. And put aside educators and universities, think about citizens. These costs are destructive, especially for citizens. I felt this quite directly just about, I can tell you exactly, 8 weeks ago when my third child was born, this extraordinary creature, Samantha Tess. And 3 days after she was born, there was a severe fear that she had jaundice. And she fell into a severe state of lethargy, and the doctor said, you've got to get her to the hospital. So I had been doing some research about this, of course, being obsessive and fearful about this as the doctor was increasingly concerned. And I'd gone to this great site, the American Family Physician, which permits you to download articles about scientific and medical issues for free. I downloaded this article and printed it off and raced. I had it in my hand as I raced to the hospital with my 3-day-old daughter, fearful of this extraordinarily destructive condition, which causes brain damage that she might, as the doctor feared, have. And so as I'm sitting there waiting for her to be seen, I'm reading this article, and I come to table 4 of the article, and this is what I find. The rights holder did not grant rights to reproduce this item in electronic media. For the missing item, I should see the original print version of this publication. And I thought, this is astonishing. This is not Britney Spears. This is not the jewel, the crown jewel of the MGM film enterprise. This is a scientific journal talking about a matter of health and science, and that they would already have built into their system a way to control whether I get access to a graph, the critical graph that I need to see to have some confidence about where my daughter sat on this fearful scale, is extraordinary. Who would think of building and deploying such a system? Why would it make sense? Of course, there are plenty of important contexts where we need this kind of control. Britney's is one. There it might make sense. But here, what are the costs here? There are significant costs. And what is the benefit? Do the benefits of this system of control exceed the cost? Is the proprietary model here one that makes sense? Now, I believe it made perfect sense in the past. The economies of production of physical journals in the past necessitated that type of control. If it was evil, it was a necessary evil. But the thing to remember about necessary evils, they are still evil. And if we can avoid them, we should avoid them. And that's exactly, of course, what the open access movement in scholarly publishing is trying to do, to replicate the good of this old system, peer review of scholarship, while securing access across the world to anybody who wants access to this knowledge, to avoid the evil, to avoid the restrictions on access which make no sense to the underlying business model of scholarship, which is universal access to knowledge. So that's the mission of this organization on whose board I used to sit, Public Library of Science. There are, of course, many others who are trying to do this. But what you should be asking in response to this debate is whether the system makes sense, because I guarantee you, the people who are driving the debate like right now are not asking that system, asking that question. Indeed, we've seen the consequence of their unthinking work before. Let me give you an example. Think about two bits of culture, very important to our culture. Number one, books, printed books. The funny thing about books is that, in an important sense, we have access to every single book published ever. And in many ways, we have access to that for free through libraries or almost free through used bookstores. There is an enormous market of creativity here, an ecology of creativity that preserves access to this extraordinarily important bit of our culture, unhindered by the costs of a copyright system. Compare that to film. Film is a compilation work, meaning it's produced by having a bunch of different copyrighted works folded into it, the story, the images, the music. To use a compilation work or to reuse a compilation work is contingent upon whether you can get the permissions of the copyright holders to the component parts. So, for example, in the very beginning of CD-ROM technology, this company, Starwave, decided they wanted to celebrate this man's career. So they wanted to produce a CD-ROM that would include clips, like 30-second clips, from every single film that Clint Eastwood ever made or appeared in. They had a team of lawyers who were assigned with the task of clearing the rights to include those 30-second clips on this CD-ROM. It took those lawyers 1 year's of work, worth of work, to go around and clear all the rights necessary to enable that simple compilation to be made accessible to celebrate the work of Clint Eastwood. Or think about a more important problem, in my view, the context of documentaries. This man, Charles Guggenheim, one of the most important documentarians from the 20th century, he made this extraordinary film of Kennedy 2 months after his assassination, Robert Kennedy, documenting his work shown only at the 1968 convention. His son, Davis Guggenheim, very famous for his Inconvenient Truth movie with Al Gore, but his daughter, Grace Guggenheim, a filmmaker on her own, is the curator of Charles Guggenheim's work. For the past 20 years, Grace has been engaged in a project to move her father's work onto DVD platform to make it accessible. It has taken 20 years of negotiations to make this possible. Think, why would it take so long? Well, documentaries are often made up of snippets of other people's work. So you might have 60 seconds from CBS in your documentary, civil rights documentary, 60 seconds of some event in the civil rights movement. Filmmakers, when they made the documentaries, took the advice of their lawyers. Their lawyers said, well, we're going to need a contract or a license to permit this. Those licenses look something like this. All rights that you have to use this work are going to be governed by this license, meaning you're not going to claim fair use if you ever want to use this work in the future. And the license will do something like grant 5 years North American educational use permission for this work, which means that after 5 years, you can't redistribute this work or move it to a different platform, display it in a different context without going back, getting permission from those original rights holders. This played out dramatically in the context of this extraordinary series, Eyes on the Prize, which of course was an account of the civil rights movement, as described by one filmmaker. It's virtually the only audiovisual purveyor of the history of the civil rights movement in America. They estimated it was going to cost up to $500,000 to re-clear the rights necessary to make this accessible in DVD platform for future generations to get access to. Now, what this means is the vast majority of documentaries from the 20th century will literally disappear from our culture because they exist, nitrate-based stock film. They will turn to dust long before anybody works out how to get around this enormous legal thicket of rights necessary simply to clear access to make it possible to preserve and make these accessible to future generations. Now, think of these two bits of culture. What is the difference between them? The difference is a regime of rights. The regime of rights under which each was created. When each was created, the regime was perfectly fine when created. Didn't matter much. But the point to see is that the regimes are radically different. They are a disaster in the context of film if we're thinking about preserving access and reuse to this bit of our culture in the future. Two regimes, and there was a choice made which regime would govern each of these fields, made by people, made by lawyers, not thinking about how their choice would affect the environment for culture in the future. Now, we're beginning to see the same kind of obliviousness in the context of science. There's an example that Science Commons Project came across. This fantastic Allen Institute for Brain Science had done extraordinary brain mapping of all sorts of contexts. This is the transgenic mouse study, which I would pretend to know something about, but I won't. We'll just say they had great brain scans here. People at Science Commons had the idea, well, what if we just scraped all those brain scans and extracted the data and dumped them into a Google Map-like context so that we can see them differently? So they did this. And they had this extraordinary way of visualizing this data in ways that the Allen Brain Institute had never even thought of. So why couldn't they do this? Well, they couldn't do it legally because, in fact, if you looked at the Allen Brain Institute site, the site is wrapped in a bunch of licenses that forbid any such reuse of their data. You can't scrape data from their site. So they banned the ability to make this extraordinarily important insight accessible to how their data was made accessible. So the point is, documentary film culture is now moving to the scientists. And what we need to do is to act to avoid this thicket, at least where it's clear this thicket doesn't give us anything good. Okay, there's the argument. Here's what I think we need to do. There are three things we could think about doing in response to this problem. Number one, we could think about changing the law. I'm sorry to report, I think this is a hopeless strategy today. I was tweeting with a bunch of you earlier before this started, and I asked how many people here would be as enraged as most of us are as we see what's coming down from the Obama administration around negotiations with for this treaty, the ACTA treaty, which is displaying that even this administration is captured by a vision of copyright regulation still stuck in the 1970s. And they are increasing the war that we are waging on our kids in the name of a business model determined in the 1970s. So if in the age of hope, it is this hopeless to think about changing the law, I think we need to move beyond the space of changing the law right now and think about what else we could be doing. So the second thing we could be doing is thinking about how to change norms, our practices. And that, of course, was the objective of the project a bunch of us launched about 7 years ago, the Creative Commons Project. Creative Commons Project has as its ideal identifying simple ways, giving authors simple ways to mark their content with the freedoms they intend their content to carry. So rather than the all rights reserved model of Britney Spears, this is a kind of some rights reserved model where you signal clearly the freedoms you have with my creative work and the restrictions that I continue to insist upon. So the freedoms could be the freedom to share the work, to remix the work, or both. And the restrictions you're allowed to impose, so you can say you can do it for non-commercial purposes, or you can say you can only do it if you share alike, meaning you give others the freedom that you inherited, or you can impose both restrictions. You add these freedoms and restrictions together and you get a bunch of licenses. There are 6 licenses. They all come in 3 layers. So one of the layers here is a human-readable commons deed. A deed that expresses in terms anybody should understand the freedoms and restrictions associated with that creative work. Second, very different, is a lawyer-readable license. A billion-page document written by the very best lawyers we could find to make enforceable the freedoms associated with this content. And third, and ultimately, in my view, most important, a machine-readable expression of the freedoms that are associated with this content, so that machines can begin to identify the freedoms that run with particular bits of content and make it easier for educators and scientists and artists to gather content on the basis of the freedoms that it carries. And so Yahoo and Google both now have built into their search engines the ability to filter content on the basis of these freedoms. Now, when you enable this kind of ecology, you get a certain kind of creativity. That is, in my view, the celebration, the very best kind of celebration of the kind of romantic vision that Sousa was talking about. This is still my favorite example of that. This is a song written by artist Colin Mutchler. He called it My Life. Guitar track he uploaded to a free site that allowed other people to download it under a Creative Commons license. 17-year-old violinist named Cora Beth downloaded it, added the violin track you hear on top here, renamed the song My Life Changed, and then re-uploaded it for other people to do with it as they want. I've seen a whole bunch of remixes of these. Some of them are great, some are a little bit embarrassing. There's a Japanese one, My Life Changed Absolutely, which you don't show much. But the critical point to recognize is that these creators could create, consistent with copyright law, without any lawyer standing between them. And that's the objective here, to enable people to respect the underlying rights which copyright enables them and grants them, without requiring the high cost of intervention that lawyers always will impose on the respect of those rights. So we launched this in 2002, and since that time, there's been an explosion of licenses, creative objects out there in the world marked with these licenses, in an extraordinary range, over 100 million images now at Flickr. Radiohead released a song, number one song on Amazon that was licensed under a Creative Commons license. Girl Talk is a big supporter here. Nine Inch Nails released an album under a Creative Commons license. Within the first week, they made $1.6 million on free music that was available for people to download for free because they had recognized the importance of bringing the audience upstage, and they were rewarded for that. Al Jazeera, amazingly, makes all of their video now of the Middle East available under Creative Commons license so anybody can incorporate it into news shows and commentary around the world. The White House has put the White House content under Creative Commons license. And of course, last year, Wikipedia relicensed the whole of Wikipedia under a Creative Commons license to build this infrastructure of interoperable free culture that speaks to a different business model of creativity. Then in 2005, we launched the Science Commons Project, which wanted to focus the same kind of insight in the context of science. How do we lower the transaction costs for scientists to share their work? How do we build an infrastructure to enable that voluntary sharing? So we wanted to be part of the open access movement in scholarship, and extraordinary number of journals now use our licenses, 1,000 journals, to make their content freely available under the terms of open access licenses. We then have Open Data Project, which is more complicated because data isn't technically in the United States protected by copyright. So we wanted to build a legal infrastructure to enable any of the complexities around sharing data, these unnecessary legal restrictions that creators of data believe surround their data. And that infrastructure was a protocol, we call it CC0, basically a simple way for creators or scientists to waive any possible right or claim they might have to this underlying data. And then to complement that legal infrastructure with the technical infrastructure that enables sharing. And we have been one of the most important forces behind the RDFA standard, which, when it matures and gets embedded in the infrastructure around us, will enable a much more intelligent way for these entities to share and make knowledge accessible. And then we've extended out of the virtual world into the physical world, into the open material space, to enable stuff to be more simply shared. So we have this material transfer agreement, which is like a Creative Commons license that enables anybody in the same three-layer model to facilitate the sharing of the stuff, the mice, or whatever else that you're producing without the enormous costs that are typically layered on top of lawyers insisting upon control over everything in the future. The aim of this project here is simply to simplify voluntary sharing here. And one of the most dramatic examples of this is this launched personal genome project. I don't know if you know this project where they're going to get volunteers, put them through this enormously rigorous test to make sure they understand what they're volunteering for. You literally have to get a perfect score on the online exam that they give you, and if you don't get a perfect score, you can't be considered a volunteer. These volunteers volunteer to make their gene sequence information completely available for anybody to do anything with it that they want. Now, not everybody would want to opt into this, but certain important leaders in science have done this. There are more than 1,000 volunteers that have been cleared and not yet processed here. But what will be made available are three things. Number one, complete gene sequence for these people. Number two, medical information for these people. They will give interviews that will report the whole of their medical history in a way that can be used by science. And number three, stem cells, real stem cells that will be made accessible for anybody to get access to according to a protocol. And all three of these layers are now made accessible under a CC-like infrastructure. So the gene sequence is CC0, no restrictions on it at all. Medical information, CC0, no restrictions on it at all. And the stem cells are governed by a material transfer agreement that facilitates the simple sharing of this information in a way that will explode knowledge around these gene sequence information. Finally, in 2007, we launched CC Learn, the objective of which was to try to corral or herd the cats of the open educational resources movement to help build an infrastructure of interoperable free educational resources so that the ideal of open education, which so many in this room I know have taken an enormous role in helping to push, can become a reality, can become a part of education around the world as people can take valuable resources and do stuff with it. Now, I spend this long time telling you about this enterprise, Creative Commons, because you geeks especially, have a critical role to play here. What you need to become is kind of radical, militant activists in spreading the infrastructure necessary for this infrastructure of freedom to succeed. This is code for sanity. That's what the Creative Commons Project envisions. And you need to participate in building that code. Because, of course, the educators or the scientists have more important things to do than to worry about exactly how the RDFA is being embedded inside the infrastructure that marks their content freely so others can share it. You need to build that, so that it's simple for them to play by the rules of the different ecology that is the norms or practices that we should be aspiring to. Okay, that's change the norm and practices. Finally, let me talk about ways that we might try to change fate. As impossible as this might sound, and, you know, I'm a little bit of a radical optimist about this, we have to learn from our past. I know it sounds impossible, but let's try here. We have to learn from our past. And the past I want you to think about is the contrast between books and film. And I want you to think about it in a particular context, this big debate that's growing right now around Google, what used to be called the Google Print Project, now called the Google Book Search Project. A project to Googleize books. Now, so what would that mean? Well, the books, the 18 million books that they would be Googleizing, come to them in three categories. Number one, 9% of those books are books that are in copyright and in print. So you know who the publisher is and the work is under copyright. 16% of those books are books that are in the public domain, meaning 75% of those books are books that are presumptively under copyright, but no longer in print, which practically means there's no one to ask for permission to do with those works what you might want to do with those works. So Google looked at this triad of categories and said, okay, what we're going to do first is scan all of them, and then we'll grant access to the underlying works differentially. So, three different categories. Number one, the public domain books will grant full access. So you can go and download a PDF version. It's a little bit hacked up, but, you know, whatever. It's a PDF version of the public domain work. You can store it on your own computer or share it with your friends. This is guaranteeing access to these works in electronic form for free. With respect to works that are presumptively under copyright, Google would grant at least snippet access. And this is what that looks like, literally, snippets from the book that are a couple words around the words that you might have searched on, so that you know that the book might have something to do with the particular thing you're searching for, and then it gives you links either to buy a used book or to get the book at your library. And third, with respect to works that are in copyright and where there's a publisher to talk to, Google would give as much permission as the publishers or authors would allow. So here's an example of a book like that where you can actually search and see a couple pages around the search term because the author or publisher has given permission for that more expansive access. Now, not surprisingly, not everybody loves Google or the Google Book Search Project. And of course, in the United States, when you don't love someone, what you typically do is sue them. So that's what happened with the Association of American Publishers and the Authors Guild, who banded together to file this lawsuit against Google, saying that Google was engaged in massive copyright infringement. And their claim was, before Google could scan the 18 million books, they had to clear permissions that would be required by the copyright owners if copyright still survived in any of those 18 million books. So what would that mean precisely? What would it mean to the practical business of running a project like the Google Book Search Project? Well, the public domain books, assuming you could figure out what's in the public domain or not relatively easily, wouldn't matter much because there's no rights holders there to talk to. 16% could be included in this library without any problem. The in-print and in-copyright books, also not a problem. Indeed, every one of these publishers had already entered into agreements with Google to permit Google to grant significant access beyond just snippet access before Google launched this project. But the thing to recognize is that if the rule of the Association of the American Publishers or the Authors Guild were adopted as law, 75% of the books in our library would literally disappear from this index because there is no way to clear rights here practically, because there's no simple, obvious person to ask, because the copyright system is an enormously inefficient property system that doesn't even tell us practically who owns what. So this project, launched and then lawsuit filed against it, was then purportedly settled by an agreement last October. The agreement says that basically 20% of all of the books in that middle category would be available freely to people as they went across the Google Book Search library, freely in the sense that Google was going to pay for that right, but at least the user could get access to it for free. And then you would have the right to purchase the full book, and that money the user would pay for would then go into a pool that would be held by some new corporation that would give it out to those orphaned authors, assuming they could be found someday in the future. What the settlement left open, importantly, was whether what Google did originally should be considered fair use. Google rightly, in my view, insisted that their original plan was protected by fair use, and they did not give up that claim in the settlement. But, of course, the Authors Guild disagrees with that. So whether it's fair use to make these scan or snippets. So that was still held open, but the project would now open 20% of these books up, and obviously 20% is more than snippets. Now, in my view, there's an important progress in this settlement. 20% of this gaping hole is better than none. So we are making some progress here, and it's more than fair use, and obviously more access here is better. But I think the thing to recognize is the way that this is good only statically. And the fear I have is the dynamic consequence of establishing a structure like this with the enormously large players of a relatively large oligopoly of rights holders on one side and a very powerful company like Google on the other. Because the question we need to ask is, what ecology will this structure produce for accessing our culture? The ecology of access today, of course, is the access of the library, which is free access to the whole book, not 20% of the book, and the right to buy access to something more. The settlement establishes a world that's radically different. Indeed, this 20% is a simplification. If you read the 140-page settlement, you'll see that there's, in fact, a radically complex formula, depending on the kind of work or the kind of copyright involved in the work, for determining how much you get access to for free. And my fear, a fear that was only exacerbated as I tried to learn about the disease I thought my daughter had. Oh, I didn't tell you the punchline. She's fine. She didn't have the disease. Yeah. My fear is that this structure will push us in the direction of doing to books what we did to documentary films. It's a future not of a digital library. It's a future of a digital bookstore. Indeed, worse than a digital bookstore, because this is a digital bookstore with all the freedom of a library of documentaries, which, of course, we understand now to be essentially none because of the enormous complexity built in by this obsessive permission culture produced by lawyers and oligopolies, oblivious to the costs that their system will produce on the future of access to knowledge and culture. We need to wake them up to these costs. Now, there are insanely hard questions here, not just questions of competition and privacy that get raised by the Google Book Search settlement, but questions of this ecology of access that this settlement begins to cement. We need to wake people up to the fact that there's a need to restrike a balance in copyright between how we preserve access to our culture without destroying the incentives that certain parts of that culture need to produce great new works, how we protect access to the past without protecting the past against the future. And we need to begin that conversation with humility. None of us know precisely how this should be done. We in this community love to focus on their limits, the limits of private companies, the limits of the government, the limits of the oligopolies like BMI, ASCAP, our rights holders. But am I the only academic who's also fearful of the limits of academics in understanding what this future would be like? Am I the only one terrified about a set of rules written by us that would define what the future would be like? I think we need to recognize both sides here have limits. See this settlement as an important experiment, but recognize an extremely important insight given to us by Peter Drucker, as he wrote, "There's nothing so useless as doing efficiently that which should not be done at all." And as we think about a future of knowledge as documentary films, we have to ask whether that should be done at all. Okay, one more plea. The end here. So I was invited to come give a talk at this place. This is the Association of the Bar of the City of New York. Not many lawyers were going to come to my talk, but anyway, it was at the Bar of the City of New York, and I was part of a panel as well. And I was to give a talk before the panel, but the panel was held in this room. You see this room, this beautiful old room in the center of New York, these beautiful velvet carpets and velvet curtains and red carpet. And as I looked around this room, the room filled quickly, it was packed by the time this started, filled with artists and creators and a couple lawyers. And the people had all come together because they were eager to learn how it was that they could create using digital technologies consistent with the law of fair use. So the panel opened up, and of course, as you might know, the law of fair use basically in America has four factors. The Supreme Court has said, we're not going to give you any formula. Judges have to weigh each of the four factors in each case. So you have to understand the four factors and then have some deep understanding about how they get weighed together. And the lawyers who were organizing this event decided a simple, obvious thing to do was to give each of four lawyers 15 minutes to describe each of those four factors, with the plan being that 60 minutes later, the audience would understand the law of fair use. But as I sat there and looked out at the audience, the reaction instead was something more like this. And as I saw that reaction and I saw the room, I began to daydream a little bit about, what exactly this room reminded me of. And a little known fact about my early history, when I was a kid, just at college, I spent some time traveling in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, and I began to recognize that's what this room was reminding me of. And as I sat there listening to those lawyers, reflecting back on my time traveling in spaces like this, when in fact these spaces were occupied by the Communist Party, I began to wonder, when was it in the history of the Soviet system that you could have convinced members of the Politburo that the system had failed? Right? Now, 76 was way too early. It was chugging along, you know, okay in 76. 89 is too late. If they didn't get it by 89, they were never going to get it. So when was it between 76 and 89 that you could have convinced them that the system was failing? And more importantly, what could you have said to these members of the Politburo to convince them that this romantic ideal of their youth had crashed and burned, and to continue with their system was to betray a certain kind of insanity? Because as I listen to lawyers, what I think of as us, or at least us from the United States, insist, nothing has changed. The same rules should apply. It's the pirates who are the deviants. Actually, they are pretty deviant, but I begin to recognize that it is we who are insane here. The existing system of copyright could never work in the digital age. Either we will force our kids to stop creating, or they will force on us a revolution. Both options, in my view, are just not acceptable. What all of us need to recognize is that there is a growing copyright abolitionist movement out there. People who believe that copyright was a good idea for a time long gone, and we just need to eliminate it and move on with a world where there is no copyright. I am against abolitionism. I believe copyright is an essential part of the cultural industries and will be essential in the digital age, even if I believe it needs to be radically changed in all sorts of important ways, and it doesn't apply the same in science and in education. But I believe it is essential to a diverse and rich, in all senses of that word, culture. So in this sense, I feel a lot like Gorbachev, not so much like Yeltsin. I'm kind of an old communist, just trying to preserve the system in the context of two extremes. I'm against these extremes, both of which I think would destroy the system. Now, you might look at this and say, you know, you don't have anything invested in the system. You don't care much about copyright. If it dies, who cares? Whatever. So let me make one final plea to bring you into this battle. You all know we're in the middle of a war. We're in the middle of many wars. I mean, actually, one war here, the copyright wars. War which the late Jack Valenti, my friend's extraordinary man, used to refer to as his own, quote, terrorist war, where apparently the terrorists in this war are our children. So we organize and wage war against these terrorists. We talk about this as a war that needs to be waged against these pirates. And the thing that we need to recognize as educators, as scientists, as parents, as people who understand the potential and uses of this technology is we can't kill this technology. We can only criminalize it. We're not going to stop our kids from creating the way they create, ways that we couldn't begin to imagine creating, at least when I was growing up. We can only drive that creativity underground. We can't make our kids passive the way that, again, I was passive growing up, the way Sousa feared. We can only make them, quote, pirates. And the question we as a culture need to ask is that any good? Our kids live in this age of prohibitions. In all sorts of contexts of their life, they live life against the law. We tell them they live life against the law, and they recognize their behavior is against the law. That recognition is extraordinarily corrosive, extraordinarily corrupting of the rule of law in a democracy. You, each of you, all of us, have let this insanity happen. You, each of you, all of us, could, if we actually stood up and did something about it, make it stop. Thank you very much.
Lawrence Lessig, director of the Edward J. Safra Foundation Center for Ethics and professor of law at Harvard University. This EDUCAUSE 2009 Annual Conference Podcast is sponsored by Juniper Networks and Quest Communications International. Thanks for listening.